There's been a big kidnapping on the West Coast. The victim is Patricia Hearst, the daughter of newspaper executive Randolph Hearst and a granddaughter of the legendary William Randolph Hearst. Richard Threlkeld reports.
Patricia Hearst is 19 and a sophomore at Berkeley. She and her fiancé were in her apartment in this building near the campus last night when a woman and two armed men burst in, beat and bound her fiancé and a neighbor, dragged Patricia down the stairs, threw her into the trunk of a car, and drove off, firing a volley of shots around the neighborhood as they left. The neighbors were terrified.
Well, I heard a scream, and then I heard what were gunshots. And I looked out the window, and all I saw were the sparks of the gun going off, and I hit the floor.
Did you hear the girl who was being taken out say anything?
Well, I heard her pleading, "Please, no, not me," or words to that effect.
Today, police were digging bullets out of parked cars and windows and walls all up and down the street. They later found the empty getaway car. It had been stolen and abandoned. Police don't have an awful lot of leads, but they know this kidnapping was too well organized to be spur of the moment.
Looked like a planned operation, a quick burst into the scene, the abduction of the girl, the beating of the fiancé and the next door neighbor, and left the scene just as quick as that.
He is going to draw an error, and once again, a standing ovation for Henry Aaron. Though the confrontation for the second time, Aaron walked in the second inning. He means the tying run at the plate now, but we'll see what Downing does. Al at the belt delivers, and he's low, ball one. And that just adds to the pressure. The crowd booing. Downing has to ignore the sound effects and stay a professional and pitch his game. One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting. The outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ. 1974 is the year that I was born. 1974 is also the year that Robin Zander joined Cheap Trick. Slade's best two albums were released in 1974. The first two Kiss albums were released in 1974. 1974 is the year that Bruce Springsteen wrote and recorded his signature song and masterpiece, Born to Run. Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joined Fleetwood Mac in December of 1974. The Ramones formed in 1974. Bon Scott joined AC/DC in 1974. The first Thin Lizzy album to feature the twin guitar attack of Scott Gorham and Brian Robertson, Nightlife, came out in 1974. The first UFO album with Michael Schenker on guitar, Phenomenon, came out in 1974. What a year. This is episode number 74 of the podcast. So, on today's episode, I'm going to take a look at my top 10 personal favorite albums that came out in 1974. So much great rock music came out in 1974, it's difficult to make a definitive top 10 list, and I had to leave out a lot of great albums, like Wish You Were Here by Badfinger, Tasty by the Good Rats, Axe Victim by Bebop Deluxe, Secret Treaties by Blue Oyster Cult, Light of Love by T-Rex, which came out in Casablanca, Struggling Man by Jimmy Cliff, Get Your Wings, the second album by Aerosmith, the list goes on. Coming in at number 10 on my list of my top 10 personal favorite albums to be released in 1974 is the album that includes the song we heard at the beginning of the episode, a song called Calvary Cross. This record came out on Island Records in April of 1974, and it was the first album credited to Richard and Linda Thompson, an album called I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. What we have on this record are a couple of nice pop songs like the title track, but mostly a series of haunting folk ballads.
This cruel country has driven me down, teased me and lied, teased me. Once I was bending
fellow soldier boy, oh boy, she's spewing out the propaganda.
Propaganda.
Might makes right, you are wrong, you're right, you fight the propaganda.
Propaganda.
Propaganda. Come to our side, she does say. Come on over, she does say. When I don't need more competition for her affection, you should fight on over.
At number 9 on my list is an album called Propaganda, the fourth album by a band called Sparks. Sparks formed as Half Nelson in Los Angeles in 1968. They renamed the band Sparks in 1971. After two albums for Todd Rundgren's Bearsville label, brothers Ron and Russell Mayle relocated to the United Kingdom and crashed the glam rock scene. They secured a new record deal with Island Records, and their first UK glam album, Kimono My House, came out in May of 1974, and it was a big hit. The single This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us reached number 2 on the UK singles chart. This set the stage for the follow-up album, Propaganda, which came out in November of 1974. Kimono My House and Propaganda are definitely a pair, two of a kind, but I like Propaganda slightly more, especially because of how much I love the first two songs, At Home, At Work, At Play, and Reinforcements.
I'm on guard again, but unprepared to fend for myself in a battle. You won't tell me why the shrubbery moves, or why there always has to be a subterfusion. You won't even say at least after waging a costly seal. When a potentate ain't so potent in his state, he summons help us. You know, laterally I withdraw. What was pieces now are gone to the jaw. The painful heart for valor, please, and no heart for you to leave.
Reinforcements, reinforcements,
that can use a strong regard.
Reinforcements, reinforcements,
Queen's second album, Queen 2, while it's a great record, was kind of a transitional album, and I think Queen really found themselves on their third record, an album called Sheer Heart Attack, which came out in November of 1974 and was Queen's first hit. The single Killer Queen went to number 2 in the UK and number 12 in the US, and the album was top 10 UK, top 20 US. My favorite song on the record would have to be the last song on Side 1, written by guitarist Brian May, but sung brilliantly by Freddie Mercury. Great song called Now I'm Here.
Thank you.
At number 7 on my list is the second album by Kiss, Hotter Than Hell, which was recorded in August of 1974 and released in October. The album was recorded in LA as opposed to New York City, but with the same production team of Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise. The production job on the record has been highly criticized over the years, but I don't mind it. I kind of like the way you can hear the room. Put the headphones on and you really feel like you're there in the room with the band as they're playing the songs. And the songs on the album are pretty strong, especially my favorites. Parasite, written by Ace Frehley but sung by Gene Simmons. Comin' Home, which was co-written by Paul Stanley and Ace Frehley. And Mainline, a song written by Paul Stanley but sung by the band's drummer, Peter Criss. At number 6 on my list is Kiss's first album, self-titled record, recorded in late 1973, but released in February of 1974, just a couple of weeks after I was born. I'm pretty tired of a lot of the album. Firehouse is a huge bore to me. Nothing to Lose is pretty formulaic. I've never really liked Cold Gin that much, and 100,000 Years is good, but kind of strange. Let Me Know is a good song, but you could tell it's one of Paul Stanley's earliest compositions. But the greatness of the best songs on this record simply cannot be denied. The opening track, Strutter, is an absolute classic. Just a great 70s rock gem. Great riffs, great hooks. It really doesn't get much better. Deuce is a real ass-kicker, probably the best song Gene Simmons ever wrote. A truly inspired piece of work, and everybody loves the opening line. Get up and get your grandma out of here.
Get up and get your grandma out of here. Pick up on Jimmy's working hard this year. And be right to the things the sister do. Be right if you're feeling good.
And then there's the song that closes the album. Once again, a song written by Paul Stanley, but sung by Peter Criss. This is a masterpiece of songwriting, a song called Black Diamond.
Out on the street for a living, pictures only begun. Got you under their thumb.
Mott the Hoople's first self-titled album came out in 1969, and their breakthrough record, All the Young Dudes, was actually the band's fifth album. After the success of All the Young Dudes, Mott the Hoople released two more studio albums and their best work, a pair of killer records called Mott in 1973, and number five on my list, The Hoople, which came out in 1974. Both of these records were self-produced. The Hoople was the band's last album with frontman Ian Hunter and their highest charting record in the U.S. It's a great album. The last song, Roll Away the Stone, was a top 10 hit in the U.K., but my favorite song on the record is the first song, The Golden Age of Rock and Roll.
Roll ladies and gentlemen, the golden age of rock and roll.
The expression Sweet Fanny Adams know of its origin. However, there was a time when it would have been recognized instantly. when the name Fanny Adams made sensational headlines, creating a wave of horror, revulsion, and pity. It was here, in the small, quiet, urban town of Alton in Hampshire, that a vicious murder of an 8-year-old girl took place on August the 24th, 1867. Her name was Fanny Adams. Fanny, her friend Minnie Warner, and 7-year-old sister Lizzie set off to play. On the way, they met a young man of respectable appearance, despite the fact that he had been drinking. The man offered Minnie and Lizzie money to buy some sweets, but he wanted Fanny to accompany him to the nearby village of Sheldon for her halfpenny. Fanny took the money, but refused to go with him. So he picked her up and carried her away. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. Minnie and Lizzie continued to play and eventually went home about 5 o'clock. They met their neighbour, Mrs. Gardner, and told her what happened. She ran to tell Mrs. Adams, and the anxious women hurried towards Flood Meadow. They met the same young man returning. He admitted giving money to the girls, but said that Fanny had returned to her friends. He told them he was a clerk to a local solicitor, William Clement, and his calm composure and respectability impressed the women, and they allowed him to go. At 7 p.m, with no sign of Fanny, a search party was formed, and they found the poor child's dreadfully mutilated remains in a nearby hop field. It was a sickening scene of carnage. Sergeant William Cheney arrested 29-year-old Frederick Baker at his workplace. His clothes and shoes were splattered with blood. He was carrying 2 small knives. During the searches at his home, Baker's diary was found, and on the 24th of August, the entry read, "Killed a young girl. It was a fine hot day." The defence was centred on hereditary family insanity, but the jury returned a guilty verdict after only 15 minutes. Frederick Baker was hanged before a crowd of 5,000, a large proportion of whom consisted of women, in front of Winchester's county prison at 8 a.m. on Christmas Eve, 1867. Fanny's headstone was erected by public subscription in 1874. It was renovated a few years ago and still stands in the town cemetery. It might have been our only reminder of this tragic affair had it not been for the macabre humour of British sailors. Served with tins of mutton, the latest convenient food, they declared the butchered contents must be Sweet Fanny Adams.
Coming in at number 4 on my list is an album called Sweet Fanny Adams by UK glam band Sweet. Sweet released 2 albums in the UK in 1974, Sweet Fanny Adams and Desolation Boulevard. But the UK version of Desolation Boulevard was very different from the album of the same name that was released in the US in 1975. In fact, half of the US version of Desolation Boulevard actually came from the UK album Sweet Fanny Adams, and the UK version of Desolation Boulevard isn't nearly as good as Sweet Fanny Adams or the US version of Desolation Boulevard.
Time is right. I crashed in the jungle while trying to keep a date with my little girl who was back in the States. I was stranded in the jungle, afraid and alone, trying to figure a way to get a message back home. But I was out of know that the wreckage of my plane had been picked up and spotted in my girl in Lover's Lane. And meanwhile, back in the States.
Down the roses, stop at Fannie Mae. Gonna tell her Fannie what I heard. Her boyfriend said, don't start me talking. I'll tell her everything I know. I'm gonna break up this signal fight, cause somebody's got to go. Jack give his wife $2, go downtown and get some mocking. Gets out on the streets. Old George stopped him. He knocked her down and black in the eye. She gets back home. Tell her husband a lie. Don't start me talking. I'll tell everything I know. I'm gonna break up this signal fine.
Say, man, they tell me you think you're pretty good. Don't you know you in my neighborhood? They tell me you pretty fast on your feet. So I want you to meet me at the dance hall on Market Street. You hear?
At number three on my list is the second album by the New York Dolls, a record called Too Much Too Soon. This is a great album. You get four cover songs: Stranded in the Jungle, which was a hit single in 1956 for the Cadets, a song by Sonny Boy Williamson called Don't Start Me Talkin', There's Gonna Be a Showdown, which was a hit in 1969 for Archie Bell, and a song by the Coasters called Bad Detective. These four songs are turned into New York Dolls songs, and they're really great covers, a lot of fun. And then you get six originals by the Dolls, six incredibly great songs. This is just a really, really fun album all the way through. I just enjoy it so much. It's a perfect example of how great 70s rock could be. The album takes its name from the autobiography of Diana Barrymore, who was Drew Barrymore's aunt. And I have a book about the New York Dolls, which was also called Too Much Too Soon, and I wanted to read a passage from that book about the album title Too Much Too Soon and where it came from. Taking the name of their second album from actress Diana Barrymore's autobiography, which was later filmed under the same title, the Dolls played into the hands of fate. Too many tragic heroines can drag a boy under, and Barrymore was a classic. Born into the famed Barrymore acting dynasty, whose performances on and off stage made the Hollywood headlines of the 30s and 40s, and continues today with Drew Barrymore, Diana's life was a riches-to-rags story propelled by liquor, pills, and suicide attempts. Quote, I swallowed the pills and washed them down with whiskey, then swallowed the rest and washed them down too. Damn, I thought, I won't be able to read my obituary. Who will be at my funeral, I wonder? According to an interview with David Johansen in Circus magazine, it wasn't suicide that finally offed Diana Barrymore, but an irate partner who rammed a tennis ball down her throat. According to Wikipedia, Diana Barrymore died from an overdose of alcohol and sleeping pills, but she was at one point married to a professional tennis player. On previous episodes of the podcast, I played my favorite songs from this record. I believe Puss in Boots is the last song on the American Glam episode, and I played Who Are the Mystery Girls on the Sophomore Slump episode. Let's hear the very last song on the record, a song called Human Being. Hold down.
just mad about every little thing that I see, but I can color that with history. I'll make it just what I want it to be, while I'm blowing my change on the fan magazines with all the Hollywood refugees are screaming, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, and if I'm acting like a king, I said, well, I'm a human being. If I want to meditate, so don't you know, well, I'm a human being. If I've got to drink, so baby, 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 I'm a human being.
If Cheap Trick didn't exist, then my favorite band would be Slade. The quality of the songs in Slade's catalog, mostly written by frontman Noddy Holder and bassist Jim Lee, is difficult to top. Simply amazing songwriting and musicianship. In 3 years between October of 1971 and October of 1974, Slade had 12 consecutive top 10 hits in the UK, and half of those were number one singles. Their album Slade, S-L-A-Y-E-D, which came out in 1972, is an incredible record, one of the greatest albums of the 70s. But Slade put out two even better albums in 1974, and they are number one and number two on my list of my top 10 favorite albums released in 1974. Old New Borrowed and Blue came out in February of 74. The album was released in the U.S. as Stomp Your Hands, Clap Your Feet, minus two songs, My Town and My Friend Stan. Old New Borrowed and Blue features some of the most insanely brilliant pop singles ever written, in my opinion. Specifically, When the Lights Are Out, Every Day, and Miles Out to Sea. let's hear another amazing song off of the Slade album Old New Borrowed and Blue, a song called Do We Still Do It?
The management have requested me to sniff out the owner of these. He's just found them in the gents. Still warm. She can't be far away. Now, come on, down the shore. We don't want anybody catching cold. Winter draws on. Really? Oh, it's all right. We've just found they belong to him.
Yeah.
In November of 1974, Slade released the soundtrack to their upcoming feature film Flame, which would come out in January of 1975. Flame is actually a really good film, dark and funny. The movie's soundtrack is an astonishing piece of work. The songwriting is incredible, and that's why it's my favorite album released in 1974. Once again, the album contained different songs depending on if you purchased it in the UK or the US. In the US, two non-album singles were added, Bangin' Man and Thanks for the Memory, and these two songs replaced two very poppy songs from the UK version, Summer Song and Heaven Knows. The US version is slightly better, but both versions of the record are brilliant. The opening song on In Flame, How Does It Feel, is basically as well written and produced as a pop or rock song could possibly be. It truly doesn't get any better.
Do you know what it's like Hello, I'm Gary Crowley, and welcome to a special feature on your Slade in Flame DVD. Now, we're now going to talk about the making of the movie, and who better than to fill us in than the man himself, Noddy Holder.
Nice to be here.
Noddy, welcome. Let's go right back to the very beginning. Always a good place to start, I find. How did all of this come about?
Well, we up until 1973, we'd really been on a crest of a wave for the first 3 years of the 70s with lots of hit records, lots of number one records. We'd had six number one records. And our manager, Chas Chandler, who was the bass player in the Animals, and he was also the man who discovered Jimi Hendrix and managed and produced Jimi Hendrix. He was our manager and producer. He always took the Beatles as the blueprint of our career. He always wanted us to emulate or try to emulate the sort of stages that the Beatles had gone through. So we'd had all the number one records. We'd gone straight into number one the first day of release with three records. And he saw it that the next career move for us would be a movie. We weren't actually sure about it. I mean, everybody wants to be in a movie, don't they? But I mean, we weren't actually sure that we could pull it off. None of us had ever acted before. So it was a bit of a weird challenge for us. But he was determined. He was sure we could pull it off. But the next thing to do was to find a script or a story that he thought we could cope with. And we didn't want to end up doing... Well, me particularly didn't want to end up doing a slapstick, run-around type movie, speeded-up film and all that, because I thought that's what people would expect from us. Automatically, that's what they'd put Slade in that bag. That's what they'd be, a comedy sort of fast-moving slapstick-type film, which I thought was defeating the object a bit of making a movie, because that had been done before, with several groups had done it before. And Chas tended to agree. If we could pull it off, actually acting, and find a real good story. And initially, we had a few people sent us scripts when the feelers were put out to get stories. And Chaz's assistant was a guy called John Steele, who was actually in the Animals with him. He was the drummer in the Animals. One of the ones he came up with was a comedy, and it was a spoof on the Quatermass experiment. And it was going to be called the Quatermass Experiment. I was going to be Professor Quatermass. But Dave Hill was going to be killed in the first 15 minutes by the Triffid. So that had to go out the window because Dave wasn't going to be standing for that. So that one went to the wall. And we had a few other people sent us stuff, but nothing we really thought we could get our teeth into. I mean, we'd obviously got to do something that was based around music to pull it off. You know, that's the only thing, you know, we really did want to include a lot of music in it, obviously. And eventually, Chas tracked down this script that had come through. He actually more or less commissioned it, really, that we'd make a film about the story of a rock and roll band. And so we got various people to actually write treatments for us. And the one treatment came in, which was the treatment which eventually became Flame. But when we read it, we liked the story, the basic idea of the story, but it wasn't true to life of what a band's all about. Unless you've been in a band, they tend to write about the myth of rock and roll, not the reality of rock and roll. And we wanted to show what rock and roll was really like behind the scenes, not what the fantasy out front is, you know, that everybody sees all the glitz and glamour and the parties and all that. We wanted to show the other side of the business. And so what we did, the writer of Flame was a guy called Andrew Birkin, who was the brother of Jane Birkin, you know, who made that rather raunchy record in the 60s. And we thought we'd take him and Richard Longcrane, who was the director. He was the director of the film, and it was the first movie he'd ever directed. He's gone on to do lots of stuff since, but it was actually his first movie, directing. And we decided to take him on a tour of America, the two of them, to show him the reality of what life was like on the road. And whilst traveling between gigs, one-nighters, we would talk to him about our career, tell him stories about other bands' careers, and that would be assimilated into what Flame, the treatment that they'd sent us. So we took them to the States. I mean, they only lasted about 2 weeks on the road up. They couldn't take any more. I don't think they realised what a circus it all was. But they got enough material from us to go back and rewrite it and put it into the script. Every scene in the movie actually is true to life. Not Slade's, necessarily, but their stories from other bands. We didn't want it to be the story of Slade. We didn't want to confuse the fans or the public with making it a rockumentary of them thinking that it was Slade's story. It was loosely based on Slade's story, but with lots of other band stories thrown in.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
Let's hear another song from the Slade album, Slade in Flame, which was the soundtrack to their film Flame. Let's hear one of the songs that was on the UK version, but not the US version. This is a song by Slade called Summer Song. Until next time.
be back.